SunSounds, in partnership with the Citizens for Clean Elections Commission, is celebrating the Constitution. On August 2, 1956, President Dwight D. Eisenhower officially enacted Constitution Week as September 17th through September 23rd. The Daughters of the American Revolution petitioned Congress for a resolution to promote the education and study of America's founding document. Clean Elections is happy to celebrate Constitution Week with students and educators across the state as part of our Youth Voter Outreach Initiative. In partnership with the Civic Education and Community Engagement Committee, we're pleased to bring you the Civics Storytelling Series, a collection of civic inspiration stories and autobiographies read by local community leaders. We hope you'll enjoy these stories.
Hi, I'm Amy Chan, and I'm here to read to you today the story of John Lewis, a biography by Dr. Tanya Leslie. John Lewis is such an inspiring figure who fought in the civil rights movement nonviolently to achieve equal rights for Black Americans. And I have been so inspired by his story and his phrase that he always used, which was good trouble. I'm here because I am currently a commissioner with the Clean Elections Commission, which is a nonpartisan agency established by voters in Arizona by initiative in 1998. And one of our most important roles, I think, is our voter education aspect. We try to educate voters so that they can get registered and vote in every election they're eligible for. And that's what we want for all of you to do when you're eligible. So I hope that you will become inspired by the story of John Lewis, like I have been, and become very active members of our society when you're eligible to vote, even before you can, but definitely when you're of the age, you can register and vote in elections, just like John Lewis fought for your right to do that. And with that, I will get started reading you today's book. Chapter 1, A Hero is Born. Meet John Lewis. When John Lewis was a young boy, he was in charge of the chickens on his family's farm. He cared for them all and even named them. When he got older, he became a civil rights leader and a U.S. congressman. He spent most of his life speaking out against injustice. John Lewis was raised in an unfair America. When he was young, Black and white people lived separately and unequally. John spent his life fighting to change that, but he fought peacefully. When people yelled, John stayed silent. While others raised their fists, John lowered his hands. When people yelled out bad words, John sang out freedom songs. It is not easy to stand up for peace, especially when others act with violence. John knew that fighting for equality was dangerous. He was beaten, kicked, and spat upon. He was jailed for more than 40 times. Still, he stood his ground. He held on to his belief that people should be treated equally. People around the world watched his bravery and they joined in to help. John Lewis never stopped fighting for justice, and he never stopped believing in peace. John's America. John Lewis was born on February 21st, 1940, in a small farming community in Alabama. He lived near the city of Troy. He came from a big family. He was the third of 10 children. Most of his neighbors were family too. John spent his early life never meeting a stranger. John's family had worked on the land since the days of slavery. White Americans in the South enslaved Black people and forced them to work for free. After slavery ended in 1865, many laws and unfair practices were put in place to keep Black people down. One unfair practice was sharecropping. White landowners rented land to Black farmers. Then, at the end of the growing season, they shared the harvest. But the white landowners often took more than their fair share. They left the farmers with almost nothing. No matter how hard the Black farmers like John's family worked, they barely made enough to live on. Black and white people lived separate lives. Their children went to different schools. There were some places Black people couldn't go at all. When John tried to go to the library, he was told it was for white people only. This was called segregation. Even as a child, John could see that this way of life was unfair. John decided he needed to fight for a better world. Chapter 2, The Early Years. Preaching to the Chickens. John's parents, Eddie and Willie Mae, eventually bought a farm of their own. Now, John's family had 110 acres of land. They planted cotton, corn, and peanuts. They also had their own animals. Farming was hard work for the whole family, and everyone had to do their part. John's job was to take care of the chickens. He had to feed them and make sure their eggs were kept warm and safe. John felt a special connection to the chickens. John wanted to be a pastor, so sometimes he preached to them. Some nodded their heads. Others looked at John with curiosity. The chickens couldn't talk, but John knew they were listening. Besides the chickens, John also loved school, but there was a lot of work on the farm. Sometimes John and his brothers and sisters needed to stay home to help. John begged to go to school. He told his family how far he would fall behind. His parents felt bad, but they had no choice. Everyone had to help out. One morning, John had an idea. He hid under the front porch and waited. When he saw the school bus coming down the road, he rushed from his hiding place and ran to the bus. He got on and went to school. John's parents weren't happy, but they didn't punish him. They knew how much he liked school. This was John's first protest. Separate is not equal. John didn't know many white people when he was growing up. He was used to segregation. When he went to school, he saw the white children rode on a newer bus and had a better school building. Even though he loved his school and his teachers, this didn't seem fair. John would ask his family why things were this way. They would say, "That's just the way it is." Then, one day John went on a trip to Buffalo, New York with his uncle Otis. They were going to visit family who lived in the North. As they drove through the southern states, they didn't stop much. They couldn't. Because of segregation, they were not allowed in some of the restaurants they passed. They could get harassed or hurt. So John and Otis ate in the car. Things were different in Buffalo. John noticed that his uncles there had white neighbors. White and black people sat together and were friends. John realized that segregation didn't have to be the way things were. All around the world was changing. In 1954, a big decision was passed in the courts. It was called Brown versus Board of Education. In the decision, the court said that schools could no longer be segregated. John was excited. He thought this meant he would be able to go to a better school. But change didn't come right away. In fact, a lot of things got worse. In 1955, a 14-year-old boy named Emmett Till was murdered in Mississippi. His crime? Talking to a white woman. No one was punished for his murder. Emmett's mother was so hurt and angry. She decided the world needed to see what was done to her son. A funeral photo of Emmett was published in a magazine. People couldn't believe what they saw. The country was outraged about his murder. John was too. He wondered how he could make a difference. John heard a speech by a pastor named Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and was inspired. He thought if he became a preacher, he could reach people. Maybe he too could fight for change like Dr. King. Chapter 3, Time to Take a Stand. Faith and Courage. School segregation was finally against the law, but other types of segregation continued. White and black people still couldn't eat in the same restaurants. In parts of the South, black people had to ride in the backs of buses. If a white person wanted a seat, black passengers had to stand up. In 1955, in Montgomery, Alabama, Rosa Parks refused to stand up to let a white man sit down. This act of courage sparked a year-long bus boycott. The Montgomery bus boycott was America's first large protest for civil rights. Meanwhile, John pushed for change in his own way. He preached his first public sermon. The audience was filled with people and not chickens. Because he was only 15 years old, the story was covered in the newspaper. Then he learned about a school in Nashville, Tennessee called the American Baptist Theological Seminary. It helped Black people become ministers. John applied and was accepted after high school. The school was far from home. He had to work hard to pay for his classes. He loved learning, but he wanted to help his community. He wanted to fight for justice. Then John had an idea. He would apply to Troy University. It was a good school and close to his family. If he went to Troy, he could move home. But Troy didn't allow Black students. John wanted to desegregate the school. He knew he couldn't do it alone. So he wrote to ask Dr. King for help. Then he waited. One day, he got a letter from Dr. King. The minister wanted to meet John, the boy from Troy. John went to Montgomery to meet Dr. King. When he got there, Dr. King asked, "Are you the boy from Troy?" He had read the newspaper article about John's sermon. John couldn't believe Dr. King already knew who he was. Dr. King wanted to help John desegregate the university. They would need lawyers, and it would cost money. It was also dangerous. John could get hurt. His family could lose their jobs. Their homes might be bombed. It had happened before. John thought about it the whole ride home. What should he do? John talked to his family. They wanted to support him, but they were worried. John didn't want to put them in danger. So he wrote to Dr. King. It was a hard choice, but he would not try to desegregate Troy University after all. Instead, he went back to school in Nashville. John was disappointed, but he didn't know that this decision would change his life forever. John met a man named James Lawson Jr. James taught people about nonviolent protest. Nonviolence means working for a change peacefully. Rosa Parks started a nonviolent protest when she would not give up her seat. John liked the idea of nonviolence. He couldn't imagine hurting anyone. He didn't even want to hurt his chickens. But nonviolence is not easy, especially when others are violent toward you. John met other students who wanted to use peace to fight for change. They were men and women, Black and white. They decided to desegregate the lunch counters in their town. They practiced for months. Finally, they were ready to act. Chapter 4, Peaceful Protests. Lunch counter sit-ins. John and the other students were ready to launch their first peaceful protest. They organized a sit-in. The plan? They would sit down at a lunch counter. Then, when workers refused to serve them, they would not leave. They would just sit quietly until the store closed. The next day, they would come back and do it again. At first, the white store owners were confused. Then they got mad. They tried to get the protesters to leave. They yelled horrible things, and tried to pull them off the stools. They beat John and others and dumped food on their heads. The police came, but they arrested the protesters. It was John's first arrest. Even though John and the other protesters were in jail, the sit-ins continued. When other students heard what had happened, they came out to protest too. Eventually, they formed an organization called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the SNCC. Three lawyers agreed to help John and the others at no charge. When the protesters got out of jail, they began to plot their next move. Then one night, they got a call. The house of one of their lawyers had been bombed. Luckily, no one was hurt, but the violence had gone too far. Finally, the mayor said that the lunch counters should be desegregated. On May 10th, 1960, Nashville lunch counters served Black customers for the first time. The protesters had won one battle, but there was still more to do. Freedom rides. The SNCC continued their protests around the South. They protested segregation in movie theaters and restaurants. Other organizations joined in too. A group called the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, reached out to John. They had a plan for a protest called the Freedom Rides. The Freedom Riders wanted an end to segregation in bus stations. The waiting rooms and restrooms in bus stations in the South still didn't allow Black people. The law said they had to, but it was not usually enforced. John traveled to Washington, D.C. to meet the Freedom Riders, led by a man named James Farmer. The group spent weeks preparing for their protest. Then, on May 4th, 1961, John and the rest of the protesters began their bus ride. The Freedom Riders were a mixed group of Black and white people. Their plan was to go into bus station waiting spaces together. The law said they had the right to do that. They wanted to see if the law was being enforced. At their first stop in the South, they tried to enter the station together. They were attacked. The riders kept going. But a terrible thing happened. While John was away for a day, the Freedom Riders bus was bombed. The riders escaped, only to be beaten by an angry mob. John worried about his friends. It could have been him on the bus. James Farmer called off the rides. It was too dangerous. But Diane Nash, a member of the SNCC, said no. Protesters like herself and John would never give up. They would continue to fight using nonviolence wherever they found injustice. Chapter 5, The Struggle for Equal Rights. March on Washington. The fight for equal rights continued. Protests were happening all across the South. Violence against peaceful protesters was caught on video and shown on the news. Many people were hurt, including children. John escaped death several times, but he didn't let that stop him. He continued to peacefully protest. He was arrested 24 times. People saw that he was a leader. In 1963, he was asked to become chairman of the SNCC. John was just 23 years old. He felt emotional about all the violence in the country. He worried about his safety and the safety of his friends. Still, he agreed to lead the organization. Later that year, an organizer named A. Philip Randolph came up with the idea of a march in support of jobs for Black Americans. He wanted to make a big statement. He asked five other civil rights leaders for help: Martin Luther King Jr., James Farmer, Roy Wilkins, Whitney Young, and John. The group became known as the Big Six. John was the youngest member. The march was called the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. On August 28, 1963, about a quarter of a million people gathered under the Lincoln Memorial to hear speakers. Dr. King delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech. Before Dr. King went on, John gave his own speech. At first he was nervous, but then he spoke strongly. He felt hopeful that things would change. The good feeling didn't last long. Just 2 weeks later, a bomb in a Birmingham church killed four little girls. When Dr. King spoke at their funeral, 8,000 mourners came together. Then, in November, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. It was a huge loss, and the country was in pain. Kennedy believed in equal rights for everyone. He had been working on a civil rights bill. The new president, Lyndon Johnson, followed his lead. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 passed the next year. Bloody Sunday. John wanted to learn about how other Black people around the world were working to get equal rights. In 1964, he went to Africa to learn about how Black people there were struggling. Their fight was different, but there were many similarities. John learned a lot and felt ready to fight more in the United States. He and the SNCC team decided to focus on voting rights next. Though Black people had the right to vote, it was very hard for them to register. Sometimes they had to take unfair tests. Other times they were met with threats and violence. John knew that until Black people could vote for leaders who would fight for them, nothing would change. On March 7, 1965, John helped organize a march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. John knew he could get arrested, so he prepared a backpack with a few things he might need in jail, like a book, a toothbrush, and toothpaste, and an apple and an orange. Dr. King was supposed to lead the march, but he was delayed, so John led it. They walked over the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma in a peaceful line, but the police were waiting on the other side. The police attacked. The protesters were beaten with clubs and sprayed with tear gas. John was hit in the head and fell to the ground, bleeding. Meanwhile, reporters recorded what happened. The attack appeared on TV that night. This event became known as Bloody Sunday. The videos caused the nation to respond. After Bloody Sunday, leaders came to Selma to march, on March 21st, Dr. King led about 25,000 protesters from Selma to Montgomery. John was still healing from his injuries, but he marched too. They walked 50 miles over 4 days, 5 days. This time, it worked. President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act of 1965 into law. Black voters' rights were now protected. Chapter 6, Activist to Politician. The New Way Forward. In 1966, John decided it was time to leave the SNCC. He was still committed to the civil rights movement, however. He went back to school. His life became all about studying and working. Then he met Lillian Miles at a New Year's Eve party. Lillian was a librarian at Atlanta University. She shared John's passion for civil rights, and they grew close. Then Dr. King was assassinated on April 4th, 1968. John was devastated. He had spent so much time working with Dr. King. His heart was broken. But as always, he sprang into action. He put everything he had into the presidential campaign of Robert Bobby Kennedy. Bobby was running for president, just like his brother. People hoped that Bobby would take up the work his brother started, but the violence continued. On June 6, 1968, Bobby was assassinated too. John had seen so many of his friends and freedom fighters die. How much more could he take? John decided there had to be one good thing to happen in 1968. So on December 21st, 1968, he and Lillian were married. They welcomed a new year of hope together. Congressman John Lewis. John and Lillian continued to fight for civil rights, and John continued his work on voter registration. In 1970, he took over as the director for the Voter Education Project. He helped register millions of voters. One of the first things he did was create a poster to inspire people. It showed two strong black hands. One hand was pulling cotton, and the other was casting a ballot. It said, "Hands that pick cotton now can pick our public officials." More than 10,000 posters were made and distributed throughout the South. Meanwhile, his personal life was also beginning to change. In 1976, John and Lillian adopted their son, John Miles Lewis. Then John's friends and family asked him to consider taking on a new role. He had always fought for voters' rights. What if he was the person people could vote for? In 1977, John ran to become a U.S. congressman. He lost the election. Instead, he took on a new role. President Jimmy Carter appointed him to run a government program called ACTION. The program organized volunteers across the country. In 1981, John ran for a seat on the Atlanta City Council and won. He held that seat until 1986. Then, he decided to run for Congress again. This time, he won. Chapter 7, We Shall Overcome Someday. Equality for All People. John Lewis was elected to Congress on November 4th, 1986. He was reelected 16 times, serving almost 35 years. During that time, he continued to get into good trouble fighting for what's right. He led peaceful protests while in Congress. He even got arrested. In 2016, there was a deadly shooting in Florida. John was angry. He wanted Congress to pass laws that would make it harder for people to get guns. He protested by leading a 24-hour sit-in on the floor of Congress. People began to recognize John for his important work. In 2001, he received the John F. Kennedy Profile in Courage Award for protecting the rights of all people. In 2011, he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from Barack Obama. That's one of the highest honors an American can get. Meanwhile, John wrote books about his life. He even wrote a graphic novel. But it wasn't all celebrations for John. In 2012, he lost his beloved wife, Lillian. He was very sad, but he continued to work hard. In 2015, he led a march back across the bridge in Alabama, where he almost lost his life. The march honored the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. He reminded the crowd that it took three tries to get across the bridge, before change happened. Then in 2019, he got bad news. He had cancer. As usual, this didn't stop John. He decided he would fight cancer. He said, "I have been in some kind of fight for freedom, equality, basic human rights for nearly my entire life. Spirit of peace, power of love." In June of 2020, John made his last public appearance. He visited Black Lives Matter Plaza in Washington, D.C. Protests had broken out across the United States after a Black man named George Floyd was killed by a police officer. John joined the protest. He wore a mask because the world was dealing with a deadly virus. A few weeks later, John died on July 17, 2020. After he passed away, a newspaper published an essay he had written. It explained why he had been at the protest for George Floyd. He wrote, "I just had to see and feel for myself that after many years of silent witness, the truth is still marching on." He was honored in Washington, D.C. A double rainbow appeared in the sky the day before his funeral. Many people came out to remember John Lewis at his funeral, even though the virus was still around. Everyone wore masks to stay safe. Three former presidents talked about working with him: Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush. They told stories of all the good trouble he got into during his life. They talked about how important peace was to John. They even remembered his chickens. The youngest speaker was 12-year-old Tiber Faw. He had become friends with John just 2 years earlier. He read one of John's favorite poems and said, "Let's honor him with getting in good trouble." John's funeral took place in the church where Dr. King had been a pastor. Then his casket was taken across the Edmund Pettus Bridge one last time. This just makes me so emotional. A newspaper published his final words. He told people to vote and said, "Though I am gone, I urge you to answer the highest calling of your heart and stand up for what you truly believe." And that is the story of John Lewis.
Hello, everybody. My name is Martin Quesada, and I'm proud to serve the people of Maryvale and Glendale in Legislative District 29 as an Arizona State Senator. I'm also an elected school board member in the Pendergast Elementary School District Governing Board, and I am an attorney. I went to ASU Law School, and I get to practice law in our courts. And so because of that, I'm really excited to read to you today a story about one of my heroes as a lawyer and as a senator. Her name is Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and she is, she was a Supreme Court justice on the United States Supreme Court. She's always been my favorite justice of all time. And so I'm really excited to read this book with you about her. The book is called The Story of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and it's a biography book for new readers by Susan B. Katz. And so let's get started. I'll read the book with you. So chapter one says, "A trailblazer is born." And that's a good picture of Ruth Bader Ginsburg there. So meet Ruth Bader Ginsburg. When Joan Ruth Bader came into the world on March 15th, 1933, she seemed born to be a fighter. She kicked so much as a baby that her big sister Marilyn called her Kiki. Everyone else loved her and called her Ruth. Ruth was a curious child who loved to read. Among her favorite books was Little Women by Louisa May Alcott, about a smart, confident girl named Jo and her sisters. Tales of strong girls surely inspired Ruth. Maybe Ruth always knew that she had an important cause to fight for. Over the course of her life, she has been a trailblazer in American history. When she grew up, Ruth became the second woman ever to sit on the Supreme Court of the United States, the highest court that makes decisions for the whole country. Ruth has helped change many laws to make the United States more fair for women. And as a leader, lawyer, and judge, she fights for justice and for equal rights for all people. Every day, Ruth works hard to improve the world we live in. What changes has she made, and what inspired her to make them? Let's journey back in time and find out. So Ruth's America. Ruth was born in 1933 in Brooklyn, New York. At that time, boys could grow up to be doctors, lawyers, writers, or anything else that they wanted to be. But girls, they were expected to become wives and mothers. Women who worked outside the home had very few options for jobs. Careers like being a nurse, a teacher, or secretary were thought of as fitting for women, but most other jobs were off limits. Women who did have jobs were paid much less than men who were doing the same work. That wasn't the only unfair thing. Even though the first presidential election in the United States took place in 1789, women weren't allowed to vote until 1920, more than 130 years later. So during this time, there was also a lot of anti-Semitism in the world. Anti-Semitism is the hatred or unfair treatment of Jewish people. Because Ruth's family was Jewish, they experienced anti-Semitism often. Once, on a road trip from New York to Pennsylvania, Ruth and her family drove past a sign that read, "No dogs or Jews allowed." Some children on Ruth Street wouldn't invite Jewish kids like Ruth over to their houses. Their mothers told them Jewish people brought bad luck. And here's a little picture of her in her car and that sign. So as terrible as that was, anti-Semitism was much worse in Europe, where Ruth's family was from. Ruth's parents and grandparents were immigrants who came to the United States searching for a safer place to live and work. By 1941, Ruth was 8 years old, and things in Europe had gotten so horrible that a war had broken out. American soldiers were sent overseas to join the fighting in World War II against Adolf Hitler, the evil leader of the Nazis in Germany, and Germany's partners, Japan and Italy. After 4 long years, on May 8, 1945, Ruth watched as all of New York City danced in the streets to celebrate the victory of America and its partners in the end of the war. Life was better after the war, but some things hadn't changed. There was still anti-Semitism, and women continued to be treated unfairly. Ruth's mom, however, believed that girls could and should study and work hard like boys. This early encouragement from her mother inspired her. Ruth would soon find that studying and working hard could change her entire life. So chapter two, and these are Ruth's early years. That's Ruth there, studying from a book. Chapter two, growing up in Brooklyn. Joan Ruth Bader started kindergarten in 1938. There were so many other kids in her class named Joan that she went by her middle name, Ruth, instead. Ruth loved to read. Her mother, Celia, took her to the public library every Friday after school. Handwriting was harder for Ruth. She was left-handed, and at the time, teachers made all children write with their right hands. This frustrated Ruth to the point of tears. She even got a D in handwriting. After that, she vowed to write only with her left hand. From a very young age, Ruth fought against even the smallest injustices. Reading is the key that opens doors to many good things in life. Reading shaped my dreams, and more reading helped me make my dreams come true. And that is a quote from Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Ruth also didn't think it was fair that girls had to take sewing and cooking while boys took workshop. She wished that she could have as many choices and opportunities as the boys had at school. So despite her D in handwriting, Ruth was always good with words. She wrote for her middle school newspaper. She was such a strong student that she was even chosen to speak at her high school graduation. Sadly, her mother became very ill with a disease called cancer, and she died just before Ruth graduated. So Ruth didn't go to her graduation. She stayed at home with her father instead. Now blazing into higher education, Ruth knew that her mother had wanted her to attend college. So just a few months after her mother's death in 1950, Ruth started at Cornell University. She was such a strong student that Cornell offered her a scholarship, which means that they give her money to help pay for her schooling. At Cornell, Ruth's life changed forever. She met a professor named Robert E. Cushman, who taught her about the country's founding document, the Constitution of the United States. He taught her that the law could help make the world a better place. Ruth also met Marty Ginsburg during her first year in college. He was 1 year ahead of her in school. Ruth remembers that he was the first man interested in her for her intelligence. They became friends first and then dated. 4 years later, Marty and Ruth got married. Ruth changed her name to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She's sometimes called RBG for short. And that's a picture of Ruth with her diploma. That same year, Ruth graduated from Cornell at the top of her class with honors. In fact, she was such an incredible student that she was accepted into Harvard Law School in Massachusetts, which is one of the best law schools in the country. RBG was going to become a lawyer. Chapter 3, A Woman in a Man's World. A big surprise. Ruth was excited to begin Harvard Law School. Her husband, Marty, had already completed his first year there. Then they got some hard news. A war had broken out in the country of Korea. America needed more soldiers to help fight. So in 1954, Marty had to take a break from law school to join the Army. The Army needed Marty to go to Oklahoma, so he and Ruth moved across the country. Ruth looked for a job there, but most companies would not hire women for the jobs that she wanted. This was one form of discrimination or unfair treatment for a certain group of people. In this case, Ruth was treated unfairly because she was a woman. Finally, Ruth found a job. Soon after, she became pregnant with her first child. When her company discovered that she was pregnant, they forced her to take a lower position that paid less money. But then she got back on track at Harvard. Ruth and Marty's first child, Jane, was born in 1955. A year after that, Ruth finally got to go to Harvard Law School. In her class, there were more than 500 men and only 9 women. One of the heads of the law school invited the 9 female students to dinner. He asked each of them, "Why are you here, taking the place of a man?" All the women had grades and intelligence equal to their male classmates, yet he wanted these women to prove or justify why they were as important as the male students. Ruth later learned that he had asked for their stories and goals so he could share them with those who doubted that women deserved to be at Harvard Law. And there's a picture of Ruth having dinner with that professor. Ruth managed to balance being a new mom and a law student at the same time. But it wasn't easy. Still, she was a born fighter. She studied hard, got excellent grades, even better grades than Marty. She was chosen to be on the Harvard Law Review, which is a special law newspaper that only accepts the top students. In 1958, during his final year of law school, Marty became very sick with cancer. Now, Ruth wasn't only going to law school and taking care of her daughter. She was also caring for her ill husband and helping him with his schoolwork, in addition to her own. Luckily, Marty got well. After he graduated, he was offered a job as a lawyer in New York City. Ruth changed law schools so she could keep the family together. And there's a picture of Ruth taking care of her husband, Marty, and taking care of her daughter, all while doing her homework. In 1959, Ruth earned her law degree from Columbia Law School in New York City. She even tied with another classmate for first in her class. She was chosen to be on the Columbia Law Review too, making her the first woman on both the Harvard Law Review and the Columbia Law Review. Despite how hard law schools made it for women, Ruth came out on top. She didn't give up on her dream of being a lawyer because she was living in a man's world. Instead, she chose to change the world. So chapter 4 is Fighting for Equality. The unemployable RBG. Even though Ruth was one of the best students at two of the top law schools in the country, it was still almost impossible for her to find a job. Most employers didn't want to hire women, and they especially didn't want to hire mothers. One of the professors from Columbia Law School, Gerald Gunther, called every judge in town to tell them about Ruth, but nobody would hire a woman with a 4-year-old daughter. Her grades were excellent, but judges worried that she would be too busy taking care of her child to work hard. Finally, Professor Gunther found someone to give Ruth a chance. He reached out to Judge Edmund Palmieri and begged him to hire Ruth as his clerk. In fact, Professor Gunther vowed to never send another Columbia student to clerk for Judge Palmieri if he didn't hire her. Judge Palmieri agreed to give Ruth the job, but Professor Gunther had to promise that if she didn't work out, he would find Judge Palmieri a male clerk. Professor Gunther agreed. Thankfully, he never needed to replace Ruth. She worked hard for Judge Palmieri and did such a great job that she kept the position for 2 years. During that time, she learned just how important a judge's decisions can be. Abroad in Sweden. After working for Judge Palmieri, Ruth traveled to Sweden in 1962 to research how courts work in other countries. She had learned Swedish the previous year. Later, she and a Swedish judge wrote a book about her work there. She even translated Sweden's judicial code or laws of the land into English. Ruth was inspired by how well women were treated in Sweden. She learned that Swedish women made up 20 to 25% of law students. One female judge she met in Sweden was 8 months pregnant and was allowed to keep working as long as she wanted. Ruth's time in Sweden showed her it was possible for women to have more equal rights than they were given in the United States. The wheels in her head began to turn. Chapter 5. It's a Women's World Too. Professor Ginsburg. After her work studying Swedish law, Ruth got a job as a law professor at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Finally, Ruth was getting opportunities that only men had been getting for hundreds of years. Ruth knew that Rutgers was paying her less money than male professors that were doing her exact same job, but she also knew that she couldn't say no to the offer. The university tried to justify its actions, saying she was paid less because her husband had a job too. Ruth did not think this answer was fair. When Ruth started teaching at Rutgers in 1963, she was one of only 20 female law professors in the whole country. While teaching there, she became pregnant with her second child. Once again, Ruth tried to hide her pregnancy for fear of being fired. In 1965, she and Marty welcomed their son James into the world. In 1971, a group of female professors, including Ruth, filed a federal lawsuit against Rutgers for discriminating against women. They took the university to court and they won. Rutgers was told it had to change the amounts it paid to women to match the amounts it paid to men for the same work. Things were starting to change for the better. Taking a stand. In the 1960s, the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, an organization that fights for human rights of all kinds, was hearing from many women and girls who were being treated unfairly. For example, an employee at a school was told to leave work without getting paid while she was pregnant. A female worker at a company was told she couldn't have health insurance because it was only for men. Also, a summer engineering program for sixth graders only allowed boys to sign up. The ACLU asked Ruth to argue these cases in court for them because she was such a great lawyer. She proudly fought for these women and the girls, and she won. Ruth helped lead the women's rights and social justice movements in America. By 1971, Rutgers Law School had the second highest number of female students in the country. Ruth was inspiring other women to become lawyers just like her. Chapter 6, Inside the Courtroom, Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. By 1972, the ACLU had created the Women's Rights Project. Its goal was to fight against gender discrimination or the unfair treatment of people because they are male or female. Ruth helped create and direct this project. In her role at the ACLU, Ruth argued 6 cases before the Supreme Court of the United States, and she won 5 of them. One case was about a man whose mother was sick. If he had been a woman, the government would have given him money to help take care of his mother. But because he was a man, the law said he was on his own. Ruth argued that this discriminated against him because he was a male, and she won. With this case, she cleverly showed that gender discrimination hurts men too. She knew that would matter to the panels of all male judges. She also knew that it would help her argue gender discrimination cases for women later on. At the same time, Ruth became a professor at Columbia Law School. She was the first woman to be hired with tenure there, which meant she could work there for as long as she wanted. She also helped write the first legal textbook on gender discrimination. The U.S. District Court of Appeals. Ruth was such a brave and successful lawyer that in 1980, President Jimmy Carter picked her to be a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. The judges on this court heard cases that had already received a decision at the state level but were being appealed. This means people were trying to get judges to change the decision. Now, Ruth wasn't just a lawyer. She was a judge. Judges do not say if they belong to a particular political party. However, some judges are more conservative in their opinions, and others are more liberal. Ruth is more liberal. That means she often believes in more help and control from the United States government. Conservatives feel the individual state governments should have more power to make decisions. During her time on the Court of Appeals, Ruth learned to work with other judges who had different opinions than hers on many issues. For example, Judge Antonin Scalia was much more conservative than Ruth, but they became great friends. They even performed in an opera together. As a judge, Ruth helped women get more equal pay and gender equality when she heard discrimination cases. She also learned that an important part of her job was expressing dissent or an opposing opinion. Chapter 7, Justice Ruth Ginsburg. The highest court in the land. The Supreme Court of the United States is the highest court in the nation. Sometimes a legal case is very important and controversial, meaning people have very different opinions on how it should be decided. When this happens, a case can move beyond a state's court system and be decided at the national level. It will then be argued in front of 9 justices on the Supreme Court, who will rule on a final decision. In March 1993, one of these 9 justice seats opened up, and President Bill Clinton needed someone to fill it. He got advice from Justice Antonin Scalia, who was then serving on the Supreme Court. President Clinton asked Justice Scalia to help him decide between 2 men. Justice Scalia told him to choose Ruth Bader Ginsburg instead. President Clinton interviewed Ruth at the White House. He was so impressed by her that he asked her to join the Supreme Court. So Ruth is no longer simply Kiki or RBG. She's now Justice Ginsburg. She became the second woman ever to sit on the Supreme Court, and she is the first Jewish woman to take on this role. Today, 3 women sit on the Supreme Court: Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, and Justice Elena Kagan. Ruth dissents. There are many cases where Ruth dissents, meaning she strongly disagrees with the majority ruling of the other justices on the Supreme Court. To this day, when she reads a dissent, she wears a special collar around the neck of her robe. She also has special collars for when she agrees with the court. Some issues argued in front of the Supreme Court include a woman's right to make decisions about her own health care and work. One famous case involved a woman named Lily Ledbetter. She was suing her employer for paying her less because she was female. Lily lost her case. The court ruled 5-4, saying she waited too long to report that she was being underpaid. Ruth thought that was absurd. In her dissent, she pointed out that women don't usually know they are being paid less, so they can't be expected to report it until they find out. After President Barack Obama took office in 2009, the first thing he signed into law was the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. Now, what happened to Lilly can't happen to anyone else. Ruth helped inspire and write that law. In 1999, Ruth found out that she had cancer. She continued working through 3 rounds of cancer treatments. She even went to court the day after Marty died to read a summary of a decision she had made as a Supreme Court justice. She knew that's what Marty would have wanted her to do. Recently, Ruth became sick again. This was the first time she missed a day on the bench in court throughout her entire treatment. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is the most senior liberal judge on the Supreme Court. True to her trailblazer nature, Ruth keeps on fighting for women's rights and human rights in her role as a Supreme Court justice on the United States. Chapter 8. So who is Ruth Bader Ginsburg? So now that you've learned who Ruth Bader Ginsburg is, this book also has a quiz at the end of the book that you can take. So I urge you all to buy this book and take the quiz so that you can learn all about who Ruth Bader Ginsburg is. She's one of my favorite Supreme Court justices ever. She's one of my favorite lawyers ever. And I was really happy to share this book with you here today. Unfortunately, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away not too long ago, but the legacy that she left on the Supreme Court and on our nation really cannot be matched. So that's why she still is my favorite justice of all times. And I'm happy that I got to share this book with you here today.
My name is Tara EJ. I'm the founder of the Love Glasses Revolution. I'm here to read you a story today. My business is choosing to see the world with love. That's why I wear the heart-shaped glasses. And I tell you this because along the way, I've learned to love myself and love the things that are unique about me. And I've learned to stand up and use my voice. And I think it's a very powerful thing to do. And I couldn't wait to read you this book today because I think this is exactly who we need to be. Okay, you ready? Your Voice is Your Superpower by Jessica and Sandy Bowler. Here we go. Your voice is your superpower. When you think of a superpower, who do you see? A masked and Cape Crusader saving kittens stuck in trees? Some superheroes are strong. Some of them can fly. But what really makes them super comes from deep inside. Good news, little hero. The power is in you. Your voice is your superpower. It lets your feelings shine through. Every voice is different. That's what makes us unique. And luckily, we all have the freedom to speak. You're free to be quiet, and you're free to be loud, free to speak up or blend in with the crowd. You're free to tell the world who you want to be. You're free to say, This is what matters to me. You're free to kneel and you're free to stand. You're free to listen or raise your hand. You're free to pray and sing, not just in the shower. Free to talk and debate about people in power. You're free to read books and sign your name to a letter. You're free to march with a sign saying, make our lives better. You're free to join a group or sit things out. Be true to who you are. It's what free speech is all about. Like all important things, free speech can be tricky. Freedom belongs to all, even when what we hear sounds icky. It might be hard to listen when we disagree, but that's what makes it possible for all speech to be free. Some superheroes have capes. Some superheroes can fly. You can be a superhero too, my friend. You just have to try. Raise your voice. Open your ears. Be part of the future we shape. Your voice is your superpower. You don't need a cape. Unless, of course, you just really like wearing capes. But don't let this be the end. Don't let this be the end of you using your voice and loving who you are, standing up for yourself, and recognize that your unique gifts, your unique things about you are needed in this world. The world needs you, and the world needs your voice. You matter.
This has been a special presentation on the Constitution with the Citizens for Clean Elections Commission and Sun Sounds of Arizona.